This podcast is a collaboration between Aftonbladet Kultur and the Institute for Future Studies, an interdisciplinary research institute that focuses on the possibilities and threats humanity has to handle, now and in the future. Knowledge and critical reflection make for better decisions. Follow our research at iffs.se.
And welcome to The New World, a podcast by me, Karin Pettersson at Aftonbladet, and
me, Georg Dietz, editor-in-chief of The New Institute.
And when we were thinking back to this year,
crazy year,
wondering whom we wanted to talk to about this year, we came up
with our dear friend,
with
Adam Tooze.
Yeah.
Who better to talk about?
Who is Adam Tooze?
He's such a polymath. I think that's the word you use. Overused, maybe, but he truly is. He's a historian for European history, but writes a lot about political economy, especially in the term in the context of austerity, and wrote this massive study of the post-financial crisis economy crashed.
It's a fantastic book. Everybody should read it who's interested in economics and politics or political economy.
Adam, good to have you.
Yeah, good to be here.
It's been a long time since we wanted to have you on the podcast, and I think the year 2020 has been crazy, mad, and tiring enough to finish it with a conversation about the future, or starting with the
with
future.
With me about the future.
With you, yeah. Now, we've been in the future mood here a bit, jumping ahead. We've been reading Kim Stanley Robinson's book, The Minister for the Future, which is, if you haven't heard about it or read it, it's highly recommendable. And it puts you in this kind of flight mode in a different way. So if you want to escape the present in some way and jump ahead. So my question for you, and you can refuse that as a historian, of course, is thinking back from the year 2030, what did we do right? In this moment of corona, slash climate, slash injustice, slash general decay, slash everything?
Well, the single most important thing that we did was that we, you know, more or less efficiently and effectively and with some huffing and puffing, shut down. I don't even like the phrase lockdown because it implies too much top-down coercion, and it seems to me to buy into a rather unpleasant discourse about that. The overwhelming, you know, extraordinary phenomenon of this year is that certainly in the first phase, the overwhelming majority of humanity made the choice to totally interrupt the ordinary course of their lives so as to respond to this medical emergency. Now, we will argue forever about, you know, the specific choices that were made, but that's a remarkable thing to have happened. It's unique in that form. And broadly speaking, it was the right thing to do.
So, are you surprised by that?
Yes, extremely. I mean, I started the year writing a book about climate change. Mm. And, you know, what we thought we knew about the political economy of climate change was that nothing would ever happen ever because why? One word, capitalism. And that turns out to be, well, just not to work very well as an explanation, as a broad grid for understanding this year. And various brave Marxists have tried to rescue themselves from this by talking about, you know, the autonomy of the state and so on. But I think that falls a little bit short. This isn't to say that, you know, in some giant humanitarian gesture, we've suddenly decided to prioritize life above everything else. That's absurd equally. Mm. So there's something profoundly complex and conflictual going on where it does appear that there are some kind of safety catches which get operated in weird ways. So I continue to find it extremely puzzling. But broadly speaking, I affirm it. Yes, if you ask one thing we did right this year is that the shutdowns took place. And really, you know, encompassingly, India, South Africa, Nigeria, everywhere, more or less. It's truly remarkable.
So I was reading Andreas Malm's book on Corona and capitalism. And
that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, but he's also arguing, if I don't remember it incorrectly, that the reason behind the world acting so aggressively or decisively is also that this crisis hit where it hurts, where the money is.
Yeah, I find that the weakest part of his argument.
Yeah?
So I spared him the reproduction of that. I just think that's facile.
Okay.
But I think he really gets to the point where he says, actually, we somehow have to reckon with the fact that this is an expression of state autonomy. Mm. I mean, those kind of like reductive arguments. It's silly because fundamentally, you know, the balance of interest is so massively the other way. Now, the idea also that billionaires couldn't ultimately protect themselves whilst allowing the rest to go is also just silly, right? So I just don't find any of that at all convincing. I find impressive is that somebody like him actually tried to make an effort to grapple with this problem, and I don't find his answers very compelling. but you know, kudos to him to actually go out on the limb so quickly. Mm.
But if we're optimistic about having solved the corona problem, then maybe we can also, in the vein of Malm, think about how to tackle the climate question in the next 10 years, what that would imply, what that would need, and in the vein of measures taken by governments.
Oh, but don't misunderstand me. I mean, don't read what I just said as saying I'm optimistic about how we tackled it. We didn't. Like, I take this to be like a total crisis here, which revealed our complete incapacity to compute intelligently any of these choices. We don't have a calculus. We don't have a language that allows us to communicate about this. You saw that even with, you know, Angela Merkel's showdown with the AfD and the Bundestag today. And we actually, this is a symptom of crisis. I mean, this year has been a crisis, but that crisis is born out of conflicting impulses. And some of those impulses are not entirely, worthy of condemnation. Some of those impulses appear to be sort of broadly speaking, well, they're totally hypocritical in many ways and they're cynical in others, but they're nevertheless, you know, there are certain safety catch mechanisms that kick in. And the strategies, on the other hand, are pure cynicism, like just didn't work out. The guys who were posturing as the really hard-nosed, you know, let's just let it blow through, it's flu. All of a sudden, when you get the Imperial College people saying, well, that'll be 500,000 dead in the UK or 2 million in the US, it crumbles, right? They don't even have, as it were, the guts. Their realism turns out to be completely unrealistic. Mm. And Trump didn't even have the nerve to say when he was shown the photos of Queens that this is Queens. It's totally unrepresentative of the rest of the United States. And none of those people vote for me anyway. So why should I give a damn? Like, if he was actually Trump? a critic, he would have done that.
I thought we'd get a Trump-free podcast, but
no.
We voted him out, so that's...
Well, that's another thing people did right this year.
So it's a happy,
looking
a happy
back
look
from
back
2030, they might conclude that one group of people did something right.
But Adam, I'm
just
curious,
about.
No, just let's stay with this a bit, because you're surprised by this ability to act somehow collectively or,
yeah,
I don't know, in a coordinated fashion, maybe is the better.
Semi-coordinated, yeah. Temporary as it was.
But how do you explain it then? Is it to protect lives? Is it solidarity? What is the, how would you...
I don't think Malm's entirely wrong that it has got something to do with rich country life expectation and assumptions, right? Mm. But those are entrenched in apparatuses which are really quite complicated and institutional. So I think broadly speaking, what happens is even if the epidemiologists don't believe in the epidemiological transition, affluent people in rich societies do believe in the epidemiological transition. In other words, they don't expect to die of any infectious disease other than flu. And when we die of flu, we don't expect to be told we're dying of flu. We expect to be told we died of pneumonia,
yeah,
or of a heart attack. Mm. We know, in fact, people are dying of flu, but that's the one epidemic we haven't effectively controlled in the rich countries. And not just for rich people in the rich countries, but for everyone in the rich countries. Because these are infectious diseases, so it matters that you actually control them for everyone. And something happened that shook that. And when that happened, we then didn't have a macro calculus that said, well, actually, you know, a couple of 100,000 deaths, is it worth 2-4% of GDP, probably not. No, we don't have that calculus. So in fact, what kicked in was, you know what, those people shouldn't die. We should do something about that. And then it centered more and more on the hospitals. So I think what's really fascinating about this is more a Foucauldian story. In other words, what's really at risk are the panopticons. Or if you think about the institutions which are problematic, they are the nodes in Foucault's account of liberal modernity. So hospitals, prisons, schools, barracks, and then multiply that with commercial society, malls, and then modern transport, so railways, airports, cruise liners. And the fear, both the fear and the objective risk of infection, is concentrated in those institutions. So the images which trigger the action in March in the West are Bergamo hospitals, Queens in New York, the image of, as it were, modern order collapsing. Now, the epidemiologist will tell us a big story about why we need to manage this, right? But the political risk, I think, is concentrated in those kind of nodes. So it's that quite inconsistent complex, because we know, after all, that this system sacrifices, quote unquote, the lives of disadvantaged minorities every year to the tune of hundreds of thousands of people across the rich, you know, rich economies. Tens of thousands of Americans die every year because they don't have health insurance. We allowed the deaths of despair phenomenon to go on for the best part of a decade before anyone paid any attention. So nothing would be more absurd to say than our system prioritizes life. You know, that would be grotesque. But clearly it triggers in a very powerful way when shocked, like when something happens to the assumptions and distributions and the structures which are assumed to regulate the life and death process, the political economy of living and dying. When that happens, then you get a reaction which is not necessarily functional, may in fact not add up. I'm not convinced that sacrificing the education of 1.5 billion children and young people, especially in the developing world, is a reasonable trade-off. But we didn't have a calculus for arbitrating that, right? So it's a true crisis. Yeah.
So if you say citizens did a lot of things right, government did a lot of things right, maybe in this moment of crisis, we talked a bit before about the crisis that you wrote a lot about, sort of in your major book, Crashed, the 2008 financial crisis, and the lessons learned from that moment, so for the things that went wrong in that moment, and sort of also building on the injustice that was created by those wrong decisions. I wonder how you see both the relation between 2008 and 2020, so those crises in an economic or governmental way, and how what you could learn, and if you're in the same way optimistic about sort of the measures taken to get out of the crisis that would prevent such a massive redistribution from below to the top, like in 2008 and the following years since then.
Well, that definitely hasn't happened, right? So 2020 is an inequality story. It's an inequality enhancing shock. Everything about it enhances inequality in a way even more radical than 2008. I mean, there's the QE story about 2008 and the aftermath, and then there's, of course, notably in the United States, the story of, as it were, ethnic minorities, racial minorities, and the loss of wealth that accompanied that. This is much more brutal than that. So 2020 is infinitely more brutal, A, in terms of mortality, and B, in terms of the labor market. What happened in the US this year is just completely mind-blowing. You know, the national average earning surged. Why? Because so many people at the bottom end of the labor market were losing their jobs. I mean, really, there's never been anything quite like it in that respect. And in response to that, both the Europeans and the Americans, and in fact across the world to a remarkable extent, let's just take Brazil, the United States and Europe, all three of them innovated their welfare state structures in a remarkable way, and threw a lot of money behind that, you know, very significant shares of GDP. In the Brazilian case, their deficit's going to blow up above, I think, 12% of GDP. So they're in an advanced economy mode. They're handing out that, the Bolsa, whatever it's called, to Brazilians of all social classes. Bolsonaro actually kind of discovered fiscal populism, or was handed it by Brazilian Congress, my Brazilian friends tell me. So, but in the US as well, I mean, you know, in a sort of fit of panic, US Congress passed legislation that created for the first time in American history what looks like an affluent country's welfare state. I mean, they actually paid very poor people earning very substandard wages, more money than they could earn when they were working. So disposable income went up. And in Europe, we've seen the extraordinary experiment with short-time working, which is a massive innovation and huge addition to the European toolkit. The Germans pioneered it, but now everyone's doing it, even the Brits. So those are all remarkable things, but they don't alter the fact that folks like me have gone on doing our jobs and it hasn't affected us in any way. But if you're in the tourism and travel sector, as my wife is, for instance, her business has stopped and everyone she knows that she's working with across the world has lost their jobs. And in places like Cambodia, they are actually struggling to feed their families. So, you know, there's a huge inequality shock there. And then when you compound that with the usual monetary interventions, then, of course, you've really got an engine for huge inequality. I think in terms of the comparison of 2020 and 2008, the lesson that we've learned has been driven home again is that the monetary side of this, and this is sort of the flip side of what the MMT people are trying to tell us, is the monetary side is the easy bit. It's actually sort of trivially easy. I mean, all you really need to have to say is we are a central bank and we're going to do what central banks do, which is provide infinite liquidity because we can, because money is a figment of the legal and political imagination. And so, and I don't mean that trivially, it's like language or law or something like that. So there's really no scarcity of it. So if we need more of it right now, we can make more of it. And that by itself solves the panic problem, which we had in March. I mean, the US Treasury market shock in March is really very spooky, and the sell-off in the equities and so on, which was going on worldwide. So I think that's what we've learned, right, is that in a sense, the inequality problems abiding and getting, in a sense, worse and exacerbated. There are things we can do about it, but they require, as it were, political leaps of imagination, which come and go. And the easy lever to pull every single time is the monetary policy lever. And it's now, you know, proven to be almost trivially easy to do. You could do an order of magnitude more QE than they did in 2008, literally at the flip of a switch. And it works. It works, but it only works in the limited sense that, as it were, it stabilizes panic and it revives financial markets, unsurprisingly, because it's basically just arbitraging between different types of financial asset. You know, unemployed dudes in basements on Robin Hood can do that, right? But you can't, I mean, the problem, the real economy problem remains. So we've been waiting for the vaccine and everything still continues, I think, basically to depend on that.
But I have a couple of questions, just thinking about just a minute longer, the comparison between 2008 and now. Because, I mean, what didn't happen this time is that people were worrying about austerity or...
Not yet.
So, exactly.
Oh, come on.
I know. So that's my second
about
question.
The timeline.
No. And so that's my second. But because, I mean, the fiscal stimulus, when you talk about monetary, but the fiscal stimulus has been massive and nobody mentioned it. It's just like governments blowing up their debts. So the question, of course, then is what comes after? And will there be a return to austerity? Or is this actually something... a change where because this shock was so big, governments will think that there's just no way we can do this in 10 years, save back the money in 10 years. We need to think differently about this.
So what do we don't know yet, but no, I mean, the crucial thing to do is to emphasize the timeline, right?
Yes.
And 2020 has been such a weird year that we lose perspective a little bit. So if you benchmark this against 2008, right, we're still in 2008, at the very most, if you eased it forward a bit, like, you know, we'd be in like the spring of 2009. And as we know, as Paul Krugman put it so, you know, simply and eloquently, it all went wrong in 2010. It doesn't all go wrong. Well, of course, between Georg and I,
like
in Germany, it did shift in 2009 because they passed the debt brake that summer. And in Germany, they've already started talking about debt consolidation from the very top. Angela Merkel only a week or so ago began to mention this issue. And we know Jens Weidmann has never stopped banging the drum for that. And the German interpretation, I did an event with the German ambassador in the United States, Emily Harbour, last week. And she could not, I mean, she wanted to stop our conversation and speak to the microphone or the camera and say, just so everyone understands what we did this summer, so there are no misunderstandings, is temporary and a response only to this crisis. Just so that we're clear about this. Now I can go back to talking to Wild Bantus because he thinks this is all permanent. Like, it couldn't be clearer that they do in fact envision consolidation down the line. And the EU is a battlefield politically. That's the best way to think of it always. And that battle needs to be fought. And it will depend on what political forces are arrayed on each side and how the markets react and the ECB holds the ring. And so that's it's the familiar triangle. In the US, the GOP has already flipped. I mean, the GOP literally flipped on election night, or maybe even slightly before. Like, you know, they've been holding out on the stimulus. So, no, I expect this to be a war, but I take your point about the force of the factual, and that for me is the best hope. In other words, especially in the EU, especially with regard to Italy, the debt to GDP ratio is just too high. And with regard, you know, so again, one shouldn't underestimate the ability of EU bureaucrats in the ESM, like Regling and people like that, to come up with fantastical debt diagrams by which countries achieve their notion of sustainability 50 years hence, which is what they do for Greece, right? They have a plan that gets Greece down to 70 or 80% of GDP, but it does stretch out to 2060 or something. So they might do this for Italy, but it's unreal.
But isn't the difference also coming from Sweden, a very fiscally conservative, however, social democratic country? I mean, I think the difference this time when I listen to the political discussions in my country is that we were also affected. I mean, during the financial crisis, we just felt like, you know, or the debate was very much like in Germany, that we didn't cause this, we have nothing to do with this, we don't want to pay for it, you figure it out. But this time, I mean, we also handed out a massive fiscal stimulus and massive unemployment. And so we also had to deal with it in our own space. So I wonder if that might be...
I agree,
a different dynamic to the story or to the 10 years ahead.
For sure. I think the lack of the moral hazard aspect has been crucial. And again, talking to the Germans, this is what they'll tell you. This is different, not the same. But the problem is that the two things then overlap, right? And the July compromise in the EU just didn't deal with the legacy issues, didn't touch them, refused to touch them, doesn't even address the fact that the vast majority of stimulus spending now is being done on national budgets, not by way of the EU recovery fund and Next Gen EU. So the answer remains the ECB, which is totally normal and totally fine. And if everyone can agree just not to talk about it and not to politicize it, that is the solution. And, you know, if on the one hand, a bunch of people say that we ought to be cancelling the debts on the books of the ECB, as Italian populists are already beginning to do, or on the other hand, we have a kind of Hans Werner Sinn faction that thinks that some sort of atomic bomb waiting to go off in the balance sheet of the ECB, both those things, you know, are very dangerous, which is why that May moment with the German Supreme Court was so striking. But the other thing to reckon with is the argument, which has already been made, was then sort of considered distasteful, but I think will immediately come back once the crisis is over, which is, you know what, if we were so well prepared for this crisis because we did debt brake before the crisis. And so the best thing for everyone in the world will be to be like us, to have lots of fiscal room. And in the advanced economies, I think that's largely cynical. In the emerging market economies, it's actually kind of a more serious argument because they actually have to, if you like, bargain with powerful financial markets, which can overpower them. And there's certainly a way, and they don't have much of a safety net. And there, I think it's quite possible to make the case tactically that being a Peru, for instance, puts you in a position, better position than being in Ecuador. So Ecuador is already at the point of going over the edge and compounds a crisis by a default. Whereas Peru literally issued a century bond last week for 3% interest rate, a 3% yield on 100 years of borrowing from Peru. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? And they're able to do that because their existing debt to GDP level is not that high.
Yeah.
So they take advantage of the copper boom when it came, paid down debt. And there is a real tactical logic. I'm not saying it's ideal that it doesn't have costs. Of course it does. But if you're in a position of inferiority within this global system, wired as it is, you know, why not play the game that way?
Me being the German in the room, I won't contest your assessment. I just want to introduce the a German element of irrationality, which is part of the austerity.
Irrationality.
Irrationality, so, which okay. is part of the austerity myth as well. But so in a grander sense, and then if coming from a country that might eventually nominate somebody from BlackRock as a chancellor candidate for the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. So that is, I mean, per se, a fun fact of 2021 mm-hmm. to come. Anyway, so I would like to stick a little bit with this 2008.
Instead of your entire government in the American case, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah, that is
we'll
actually...
We'll come back to that.
No, that now.
Okay, now. It's now.
Now okay. is the time. Okay. Because I think it's fascinating that we're like stuck in this year in a way that time has been eliminated. It feels like, is it March? Is it September? You don't know where you are. And historical sense as well. So we don't know, is it really the third term of Obama? So is that really mm-hmm. true? Is that, oh yeah, I guess it's true. Or is it still, as you say,
term.
The fourth term? And it actually is the third term of Obama. So yeah. Because it is, and it's, as you point out, it's a strikingly similar situation. So he came into office inheriting this mess. Biden, the reinvention of or creation of Obama in some way, or we can argue about that, but he's coming back with some of the same truths, some of the same people, some of the same rationality and inheriting a mess. So he might, why wouldn't he just do the same things? I mean, you both had a very optimistic take on the welfare state being suddenly magically invented or reinvented. Well, and that
what?
Might.
What? No.
No. Anyway. So,
no. It's more like. That was... Oh, no, we don't want to see that. Oh, no, we don't want to see that.
Okay. No, it was just an aside. But what happens? Who's BlackRock Biden? What happens now with this, with the mess they inherited? Will he sort of do anything with it? And also at the same time, the return, we talked about that as well, Karen and I, the return of Obama as somehow a figure that must sort of make you turn over in your non-existing grave. Somehow like he's like all of a sudden a non-political hero of something that's beyond the facts of what he did in economic terms in those 2 years. He wrote about it in his memoir. So it's a weird moment in history that this is kind of rectified Obama, but and doubly rectified by his biography.
No, it's this idea of coming back to normalcy, but
there was no.
Yeah. Where's the normal? What's the normalcy?
Yeah, where did the normalcy lead to? Like, yeah. I mean, Trump came out of normalcy.
Yeah, exactly.
Palin was part of that normalcy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, no, I mean, I all of those categories seem to me they have to be understood as, you know, internal to the conversation amongst American liberals of some kind. Mm. And I have to say, it's really come home to me hard. I mean, I teach a lot of very left-wing Americans, graduate students, and I hadn't really quite ever understood their distaste for New York Times style liberalism until I actually witnessed the spectacle of this fall. Because I realized I'd never been here during a transition that went from a Republican to a Democratic administration. And I didn't understand in the, you know, because I'd seen these transitions in Europe.
Because during Trump, everybody was kind of on the same side, but now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And well, not entirely. I mean, my truly left-wing
hardcore
friends actually refused those terms.
Yeah.
Because Trump, after all, did reveal rather interesting things about the power of, you know, not the deep state is such a polemical term, but it's clear that there is a liberal establishment in the United States, and it was deeply entrenched in the entire apparatus of the American state. And that makes a difference. Mercifully, like, you know, I don't have any problem owning that. I'm profoundly grateful for it. And kind of growing up in the Federal Republic of Germany, nor am I embarrassed about the fact that certain sorts of democratic norms have to be owned, the value decisions, and then they have to be defended. You know, you need a concept of a democracy that can defend itself. Fair after democracy is not, I think, a bad concept per se. Anyway, yes, I do think we are in some sort of strange loop. It has been shocking to me the extent to which the Biden people just simply think they can take up where the record stopped.
Yeah.
You know, we skipped a track and then we're back. And I mean, the term American leadership is the one that, as it were, the idea, as it were, that on issue after issue is truly
but
staggering.
But isn't that also, can I just jump in here? Because I just read the Obama memoir, and I've just been living through these years, and this book was, I think it was very revealing in a way. And then I went back to the financial crisis, and I went back to your book, Adam. And it's just striking to remember the
how massive the consequences of the shock were and how inadequate the political response was, and now also how much it contributed to the loss of faith then in the liberal world order and the rise of authoritarian. It's just not part of the story. It's all cultural. It's all, I don't know, about values. Mm. It's nothing. There's nothing material almost in the discussion. And yeah,
I think it's really worth saying though, in defense, of the Biden transition team, which is all we've seen so far, right? It consists of many different levels.
Janet Yellen is great.
And it's a very complex kind of group. And it's clear that large numbers of them fully understand the failure of the Obama administration to take advantage of the crisis of 2009-10. Completely. I mean, after all, crashed is not, it's not in that sense a work of original scholarship. It's based on the narratives produced by the veterans of that moment and their analysis and self-critical analysis of it. And the folks, I can vouch for the fact that the folks, many of the people in the transition team are completely comprehending of that narrative. Mm. And everything is organized around that. The problem, of course, objectively, is that their political situation is much, much weaker than that of Obama, because Obama had, it was very slim, but he nevertheless had working majorities in both houses of Congress. Mm. And that's not their position at all. And clearly, as bad as Palin and the Tea Party were, the QAnon wing of the Republican Party now is in a different league. I mean, it is, it's a whole other level of dysfunction that we're seeing on the right wing of American politics, and the way in which the transition has been handled tactically by the GOP. The fact that we even need to say that, right, itself constitutes an extraordinary shift. And the courts are now packed with Republicans, essentially, at all levels. So if they go the route that the Obama administration went after they lost their control of the Congress, they're going to face dogged opposition at all levels of the American judiciary. So notably on things like environmental policy, they're going to run into a brick wall, because it was the American courts that handed them the opportunity to use the EPA to do climate policy, and they're most likely going to lose that anyway. So I think, in fairness to the Biden people, if they get to do an Obama rerun, they'll all of them feel incredibly fortunate. And it isn't because that's all they know. There is an element which is, as it were, regurgitative, and they can't help themselves. But when they start talking concretely about the tactics of next year, they're very smart. They've read that they know exactly what they're up against. And yes, they understand the problem. There just may not be much they can do. So I think, in fact, at this moment, that's another reason that people are clinging to Obama, because really that would be the best we can hope for. And that's not promising.
But can we talk about the problem, because I think it's interesting to identify what the problem is. And the question is the economy the problem, or is ecology the problem? So is it the focus on something that is rebuilding panically a machine that is wrecking our future? Wouldn't that be the moment now to really shift course? Or is there an alternative to shifting course, even given the facts of climate crisis? And I would like to sort of understand a little bit also what you're thinking about is in your book at the moment. You write about the climate history of the climate crisis, sort of, and how you see the relationship between economic somehow constraints or economic automatism and the ability to shift course. I can see that the realities aren't sort of on the ground like that for Biden. And in Germany would be different, but is there even a thinking space for that? And that has to do with the definition of the problem, and that I find so worrying, that you limit yourself, a lot of people limit themselves immediately to defining the problem as something very, rather short term, and that has brought us into that crisis.
On the American point still, I think it's worth saying that it's not in the choice between culture and the economy or social forces is unhelpfully abstract, right? In the sense that concrete, the problem in the United States is a combination of those two factors with the very peculiar political institutions of the American Republic as they were created in the 18th century and have been continuously modified or not modified since, right? I mean, the bottom line remains that a majority of Americans voted for Biden. In fact, Republicans haven't won a majority of the popular vote in many elections now. And the overwhelming majority of, as it were, the progressive, dynamically expanding part, which dominates the future of America in the 21st century, votes for a party which, broadly speaking, is very like its European counterparts. The problem is that the 18th century constitutional structure provides this massive check and balance system, which 20 years from now will be grotesquely misaligned. You know, and the fact that South Dakota has two senators and New York State has two and California has two produces this, you know, truly grotesque disproportions and hands, as it were, the possibility for a self-sustaining and self-entrenching value conservative culture wars rearguard, hands them the game. Like, it's incredibly difficult within this political structure to make change because you have to end up compromising with increasingly dwindling minorities of people who do not represent the future of the United States or anywhere else. So anyway, so that's, I think it's worth saying, right? Between culture and the economy, there is, as it were, the mediating structures of the American polity, which are very peculiar, idiosyncratic, and they're totally decisive. Not to mention the two-party system. And anyway, so all of that on the problem of climate, all of that then comes home to roost, right? Because the de facto constraint on any kind of international agreement on climate policy all the way back to the 1990s has been the veto exercised by conservative senators. And this goes all the way back to Kyoto. And there are two elements of that. One, which is overemphasized in my view, which is climate denialism, which I think somebody like Naomi Klein quite rightly reinterprets as essentially a defense of the socioeconomic status quo against the sort of interventionism that will be necessary. And the second element, vastly underestimated in the international assessments, is that the Americans always wanted Paris. In other words, they were never going to agree to a deal which didn't include China because they saw China coming. And they understood, they didn't anticipate quite how rapidly Chinese emissions would explode, but they were not going to do a deal in 1997 that did not bind on China. Better no deal than one that didn't bind China. And to that extent, you have to say that they were profoundly realistic, and they always interpreted this problem as geoeconomic, and the bargain over carbon is a bargain over a global distribution of economic power. And they viewed China right from the very beginning as the central problem. And Angela Merkel and the Europeans underwrote a set of deals between the Berlin COP meeting and Kyoto, which enshrines the exclusion of the big emerging markets from the carbon restrictions, which was simply never going to be accepted by the United States. And the long path to, you know, 20-year path to Paris is finally gets us to a framework which the Americans can actually work within. And makes, you know, from the point of view of the current global distribution of emissions rather than the matter of climate justice, the retrospective assessment actually is clearly essential to managing the problem going forward from here. So those are the two elements in, as it were, the climate politics debate in the United States, which still bind. And in a sense, China's outflanked the Americans now because the Biden team thought they were going to come in and do a grand bargain in which they would generously agree to sort of bind themselves for the next 4 years until a Republican was elected president. And the Chinese would, in exchange, agree to, you know, some commitment to neutrality. And the Xi just threw that up in the air on the 22nd of September and said, no, we're just going to do it. There's no bargaining here. So it's quite unclear what the Biden people really think their bargain is going to be. It would be very useful if they could bring in the big EMs and Australia and Canada. That by itself would be massive. But the constraint remains. There is no consensus in American society on this. And so to that extent, the realistic assessment, I think, is that it's all going to be driven by technology and economics. And that will work. And the big states already in the United States for renewable energy production are all red states. It's the Dakotas, Nebraskas, the Texases, because they've got abundant sun and wind, and so it just doesn't make any sense not to use renewable energy. But it has, I think, that's the only binding component in the US. It's very, I think, within the timescales in which we need change to happen, the prospect of, as it were, collective conversion or the depolarization of American politics just seems unrealistic. So I think in the US case, it's all about those cost curves. And you could imagine various types of technical intervention by way of mortgages for the housing sector, but that I think is the kind of the limit essentially of what we can expect out of the US.
So Georg mentioned in the beginning that we've been reading this book, Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson, and it's a very near future climate, not dystopia, it's quite optimistic, but realistic somehow. And in the novel, it's basically what happens is that there's this big shock to the system, maybe a bit like the pandemic, in the sense that it just shakes up the whole system. And what happens is that there's this massive heat wave in India, which kills 20 million people. And then that offsets a political reaction. But in his view, eventually it's not technology that is the salvation to the climate crisis, it's economic inventions. And it's such an interesting book. So what happens eventually is that central bankers issue this carbon coin as a reward for actions that keep oil and gas in the ground. Mm-hmm. And this carbone, which is called, begins to replace the dollar as the underpinning of the global economy. And of course, I mean, this sounds utopian, but I just wanted to, like, is it possible to, isn't it today still a fact that the financial system, the economic system is driving, is incentivizing the use of carbon to a degree that is just very difficult to change directions? And what are the most efficient tools, would you think, in terms of, is it a carbon tax? Is it a price on carbon? What are the tools necessary to just change the incentives around?
I think most people agree it's like a triple, right? You remove current subsidies to fossil fuel use, so you just simply bring them within the same regime, and you conceivably even introduce various types of penalty. Then you need carbon taxation. We need a minimum global carbon price and license for states to do carbon border adjustment to enforce that. But we've seen in countries like the UK, which after all is hardly the first country you'd think of as a green leader, but the introduction of a minimum carbon price in the UK has changed the way electricity is generated in that country very quickly. It's not the German vision of a petit bourgeois, you know, greening from below. It's a big corporate greening, but it just cuts carbon out of your electricity production, which is what we need to do as quickly as possible. And then I think, and I'm totally on board, well, there's four elements to this, aren't there? The third element is regulation. I think, again, the UK is doing the right thing. You need to pre-announce that basically internal combustion engine cars will be phased out, and this is the timeline. And so big markets simply say, enough with that, prepare for the transition. I would favour doing things like intervening in housing mortgage systems so as to require changes to domestic insulation. We know it's a series of, like, in sense, sort of almost unbelievably trivial adjustments that need to be made, but cumulative they make a gigantic difference, and housing is a big part of that. And housing is a sector that's very heavily regulated and one in which we already intervene financially by way of subsidy systems for mortgages. And then the fourth element will be some kind of investment strategy for the bits of the investment that will not follow. Because if you do all of those other things, pricing, regulation, removing subsidies, the balance of private investment will shift, and it will shift very rapidly because, you know, making money is a very powerful incentive for very smart people who will move a lot of money very quickly if they see the opportunity. And we are beginning to see that across lots of different sectors already. They, in fact, may go crazy, like they've gone for Tesla, which is now valued at, you know, more than all other car makers in the entire world in America, right? So, yeah. You know, big figure. But there are going to be areas of investment which just simply won't happen without public subsidy. And there are going to be parts of the world which can't do with this out. So that will be like the four-fold, four-pronged strategy. And quite a lot of this can be done without technological evolution. But in a sense, you know, when I say, you know, count on the cost curves, it's an economist way of talking about it. I'm not offering you some gee whiz gadget. I'm just telling you that if we do enough solar panels, cost curves will take us down. They always do. And it's a sort of a black boxy strategy. So I'm with you in a sense that I think it's institutional social framing changes which will then induce technological change. Of course, I would favour a serious, like we care about it type of public investment in energy research. The problem with that is the track record is that we went into nuclear. That's the only area we've ever actually spent huge amounts of money on, which we did in the 70s and early 80s in the West. And that, I'm convinced, is a technological and political dead end. Not because I'm, you know, fundamentally anti-nuclear, but I just think, why would we go with such an expensive, cumbersome and potentially dangerous technology when there seem much more promising alternatives? So that's the kind of hitch and giddy up. I'm not on the basis of the historical track record, I'm not sure why you would necessarily trust any of the Western states as drivers of technological innovation. This isn't because I love, you know, Silicon Valley. It's just if you actually look at their track record, it's pretty mixed and it's very heavily dominated by very heavy technologies, by power considerations, by militarism in most cases. So it's not obvious to me we have a good model. It might be different in the life sciences. In any case, it needs to be much bigger. You know, we spend more on pet food nowadays than and America spends more on pet food currently than it does on energy research. Hmm.
But how do you think do you see a conflict then between this need for public investment and what we talked about before, return to austerity, perhaps, then after the corona crisis?
Yeah, no, that would be a disaster. In an environment in which you can borrow, literally get paid for borrowing money, it's just obscene that we should even be talking about this issue. Right? I mean, Germany will get paid to borrow money. If you borrowed enough, I mean, I once joked with the people in the finance ministry, they didn't get the joke, but now we actually see it. It's like,
just imagine
if you really borrowed a lot, the interest rate might go up and the savers would be really pleased with you. Right? And it's like, you know, tell me how big the 100 billion euro package would need to be until the interest rate went positive. And then like, that would be good. Like it's a win-win. If the interest rate went into positive territory, if we got some inflation, it would actually not be a bad thing. We're so deep down the other end.
So yes,
the austerity would be Mut für die Selbstverstümmelung, as the Germans call it, like voluntary self-mutilation.
I'll jump in here as the German on the team and won't engage with that again. I would like to pick up something as we somehow near slowly the end of our conversation. I would like to take it into a bit more imaginative territory, or try to, because you said something interesting, sort of leap of political imagination, you said, I think, twice in a way. So those are three words that I like. Two, at least, leap and imagination, and the politics as well, because that's the necessary way of getting it done. But where do you see that sort of coming from? As we said, sort of, there is Olaf Scholz, there is the BlackRock Mads, there is Biden, there is sort of all in the West, there is a distinct lack of political imagination. Is it China? You said, where's technology? Sort of, where are inventions? I set out to be optimistic. Now I sound gloomy, but is that, I mean, there must be a leap of political imagination by somehow. So it can't be otherwise, it feels.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that what happened, I mean, I got into the climate stuff because of the Green New Deal leap. When a bunch of American leftists harnessed the idea of climate change to the history of the New Deal, much skeptical as I am, I've really been on the record monotonously about this, I'm quite skeptical about the historical analogy, but in fairness to them, that connection, as it were, sparks a conversation, it sparks a set of ideas. And even in its attenuated forms in the program of the Biden administration, who knows what they'll be able to realize, and in Ursula von der Leyen's Green Deal, we're seeing kind of echoes of that moment. And that is an instance, I think, of political imagination of a creative kind. And all power to them, like genuinely hats off. That's exactly the sort of move that we need. So there's an example. And we haven't fully seen the full working out of that yet. And I find that inspiring.
Exactly. It's also combined to societal vision in a way.
So exactly. It's deeply problematic in lots of different ways. Yeah. It may even not be the right tactical choices, and it may get in the way of realizing, but that's an instance of political imagination at work. And I have to admit, it affected me personally in a very direct way. So it would be churlish not to admit the force of it. So there you go. There's an example. Other sorts are more conventional but very powerful. Like, so we live under the sign of whatever it takes. You know, at some moment, Mario Draghi just simply said, enough's enough. Like, this is crazy. We all understand what needs to happen here. We're going to do it. You know, and he's a conservative fundamentally, a neoliberal down to the core. So he doesn't do this just out of the blue, right? This isn't some sort of utopian. He looked at Europe's development, examined his own values, thought hard about his function and historic responsibility as the key of the federal project in Europe, and said those words. I think also in a moment of passion. I think he was furious at what he was seeing in London. You know, we know, you know, he was swearing, and this is a very elegant, very buttoned up Italian. He doesn't do that. Like, he was pissed at what he saw, and he wanted to ram this down people's throats, and he wanted to say, you know, here with all the power vested in me, you mess with me, I'll fuck you up. That's what he was really saying. You bet against this project, don't. Like, you know, that's a kind of political imagination too. And I admire that. That's really powerful. And ever since, we've been echoing it. Like, that has become the talisman of a certain sort of, it isn't imagination in the sense of,
new idea.
Things we haven't thought of before, science fiction, but it's certainly political, right? It's saying, you guys don't get it. Right. You folks do not understand what you're dealing with here. This is the force. You know, this, I'm really bringing the political down into this space. And I'm a central banker. And so I have tools you don't have. Don't mess with this. I have a certain sort of superpower. Right. And that's what we need. We need, those are real moments. And no one's forgotten it. No one ever will forget it. It's a talisman. And it helped this year that people were able to say that and measure themselves against it and say, you know, Lagarde fluffed it the first time round on March 12th and was desperate to make that right because she understood that she'd screwed up. Not really, because I think she's an economist. Or actually, she probably doesn't think she should be managing the Italian spread. She probably really doesn't. And the Germans tell her she shouldn't be. But knowing that she had missed her Draghi moment was really hurts. So I think those sorts of moments matter. And they're, you know, so those things happen, and that is kind of what we to say we need it. You know, you end up sounding like somebody we don't necessarily want to invoke, but like, or a whole sort of philosophy of history that, you know, some sort of saving thing arrives at a moment of danger. I don't think we're in that kind of world, but I don't think we should reconcile ourselves to or simply expect there not to be moments like that, because there are. And we could have had some very bad ones. I mean, Trump, after all, was a whole series of sequence. You know, this can go in lots of different directions. The political imagination is
slippery slope.
Conservative liberals are very careful about it.
No, I think in a way,
German, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
There were moments like that, not the imaginative moments, but the buck stops here kind of moments. Also in this election, the post-election process with Republican officials saying, no, this is... back the fuck off. This is...
Or whatever the senior American general saying, no, Mr. President, I have to explain something to you.
Yeah.
We don't take an oath to this. Yeah. We don't take an oath to that. The thing I take my oath to is the Constitution. Yeah. Just so we're clear. So
that's, you know, also... It's a draggy moment.
those are less creative, right? Yeah. Less expansionary, but necessary. So you know, we're talking at very high levels here. I mean, it also percolates down and it energizes people. And fact of the matter is, more Americans voted in this election that we've just had than ever before, because they really, really cared on both sides. And that's a remarkable thing. I mean, I've avoided talking about China because I think it's so easy as a sort of liberal, technocratically minded Westerner to point there, and I think we just have to guard against our own projections constantly. But am I impressed? Of course I'm impressed. Like, how could you not be impressed? I really don't understand that I don't understand. I totally understand those who are afraid or want to front up against it or regard it, you know, as a criminal enterprise or, you know, all of that. But the sort of dismissive criticism, I just don't understand. That just seems to me to be counterfactual and making life too easy for ourselves. I think we have to take it absolutely seriously.
And was as that historian, the most important thing that happened this fall? Their stance on climate, the promise on decarbonization.
It's one of the most important things. I mean, we have to see what it means.
Hmm. Are you optimistic about that? About the seriousness of the
declaration? I think the way their political system works, I don't think it's necessarily easy for them to back away from that kind of commitment. And people who really know, their response was, you know, when they say that kind of thing, they generally deliver. But it's clear that they have politics too, right? This is not a monolith. This is, you know, this is not some sort of simplistic, you know, people talk about autocracies. I mean, this is absurd, right? It's a hugely complex, massive political system. And part of what she is doing is performative. It's urging. It's saying, look, me from here on this platform, I'm saying this. So
politics.
No, the conversation starts now. So that's what I take to be going on. And everyone is, you know, we have to track what happens in the 14th five-year plan. And then what comes after that, we have to check it all the way down into the energy ministries, down to the regional level. And of course, these are entities the size of European, big European states. So, you know, what happens at that level is hugely significant. Optimistic. I'm very impressed. And I think it's the new big, it is the big news story on sort of climate political economy, for sure.
So on that note, 10 years in 2030, what did we do right? It was China and the election.
Well, okay, let's be clear about the we here.
Yeah. We shut down.
They made the climate move.
They made the climate move. Yeah, you guys in the US elected Biden, and we'll see how what plays out. Mm-hmm. And we'll Germany see. Will elect next year a BlackRock.
Yeah, with a green vassal.
Perfect.
What
could be better for 21?
Reasons to be pessimistic and some glimmers of hope or glimmers of I don't know, something. At least reason.
Yeah, no. I mean, you can't tell this even this year. You can't tell this story as one of just sheer catastrophe. I mean, it hasn't worked out that way. It's been very complicated.
Good. It's good that you remind us. I think.
Yeah, we're still in the middle of it. We're not not at the end.
Oh, no, and we're not. We're so not done. Yeah, I mean, the dying is going to go on for... I thought Merkel was quite impressive today in the Bundestag. You know, did you see her, the 590?
Yeah. No, she was very emotional. But... Yeah. But also, it was a bit underwhelming to say, well, 3 days after, like, what's the learning curve? I mean, of this... I mean, I don't want to... You said we did good. I want to sort of... I just want to shut up, but the learning curve of the government seems to be quite a flat.
Like normal. Like everyone else is.
Yeah. But you would expect after 9 months, she flat out said, I don't know about education. I don't know what's good. It's not my territory.
Well, it's actually true. I don't think we do know. Right? It's not at all clear.
But you made the point. So it's actually quite clearly true. So it is quite clear what is true, that you shouldn't... prevent school children from learning for a massive amount of time. So that is clearly not.
I agree. I think the balance of evidence is that that is a poor trade-off, and they should go to school. Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the problem is the German school system is so very poorly set up to do this. It's not Singapore. It's not South Korea.
Yes. You know, I would totally agree with.
It doesn't have. You know, it has too many copper wires and not enough bandwidth. And that makes it all the more important. So I didn't know we fundamentally disagreed about Germany. That was never really my sense about.
No. We actually agree on most things in Germany. So yeah. But it's going to be fun year 21 really to see how
interesting
how this I mean, if Merz will really work with the Greens, and if he doesn't, if the Greens won't work with him, I mean, that's going to be. Potentially, it's a massive.
I was joking, but it's like it's absolutely classic, isn't it? The Green Party collaborating with BlackRock is precisely what is actually happening. You know, I mean, And so that kind of blend of technocratic capitalism of a very abstract variety, right? Extraordinary. Yeah, BlackRock is a remarkable formation.
Let's do a special podcast on BlackRock.
When it happens.
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay. Thank you. Cheers. for your time and see you in 21.
Yes. Pleasure talking to you both. Stay well.